Chapter 12. The AIDS debate breaks the wall of silence. On June 7, 1993, more than 15,000 HIV researchers from around the world arrived in Berlin for the 9th International AIDS Conference, a four-day meeting at which the latest experimental results would be presented. Such a staggering number of scientists naturally brought with them a comparable volume of data, filling 800 lectures and 4,500 poster displays. The one-paragraph summaries of new papers alone filled two guides the size of telephone directories. No researcher at the conference could possibly review more than a small fraction of the data, a situation described by one reporter as information overload. Despite being overwhelmed and accomplishing little of substance, the AIDS officials used such meetings as public relations victories. During the previous 8 years, the annual conferences had proven to be gala events, generating week-long sensational media stories on the frightful AIDS epidemic and the heroic efforts of scientists to stop it. This time, however, things had changed. An atmosphere of pessimism hung over the Berlin conference, the participants widely acknowledging their confusion and the failures of the war on AIDS. After more than a decade of struggling and frustration as the epidemic gallops on, wrote one correspondent, researchers are being forced to re-examine assumptions they once held without question. HIV clearly could not be killing T cells directly, leaving open the question of just how it could cause AIDS. T-cell counts, once thought to represent the ultimate measure of the immune system, no longer seemed to diagnose an AIDS patient's condition accurately. AZT treatment was being discredited by preliminary results from the Concord study on nearly 2,000 patients, showing that the drug did not prolong life. And when veteran polio virologist Jonas Salk presented the results of his new HIV vaccine, the audience concluded it would not work, after all. Some listeners even called New York directly on their cellular phones to dump their stock invested in Salk's biotechnology venture. Every belief and expectation based on the HIV hypothesis was proving false in the face of new evidence. Try as they might, AIDS officials could not prevent the general impression that 12 years of research was falling to pieces. Although no one in the AIDS establishment questioned the HIV hypothesis itself, clearly the confidence of many scientists was weakening. Science magazine had anticipated the negative mood the previous week with a special issue entitled AIDS, the Unanswered Questions, of which more than 40 pages were devoted to the cover story. The Berlin conference also marked the first attendance by dissenters against the HIV hypothesis, who were surprised to find serious interest from many conference participants. The mood even affected Robert Gallo, who became touchy with reporters when asked about his conviction on scientific misconduct charges. The conference, in fact, symbolized the changing tide in the AIDS debate. The next International AIDS Conference was held in Yokohama, Japan in 1994. Again, more than 10,000 AIDS jet-setters met, and again, nothing was offered to prevent or cure AIDS. An AIDS vaccine, initially promised by Gallo 10 years earlier for 1986, was now scheduled for the next century. One more annual AIDS statistic had doubled in America after the CDC had once again increased its catalog of AIDS diseases, now to about 30. Public health officials could still not demonstrate that they had saved any lives by controlling the blood supply, nor through their programs for promoting and distributing condoms and sterile injection needles. Worst of all, none of the virus-based predictions had been borne out. AIDS has not exploded into the heterosexual population, as do all other sexually transmitted diseases, nor can doctors predict the course of illness in any given patient. And in contrast to the official prediction that HIV would kill virtually all infected people, 17 million HIV positives, including more than 1 million Americans, have remained AIDS-free for nearly a decade. AIDS officials can neither control nor predict the epidemic, leaving AZT therapy as their only consistent answer. The development of an effective treatment for AIDS has been equally disappointing. The final report of the Concord study shattered the hope that antiviral DNA chain terminators such as AZT might at least prevent AIDS. The chilling news was that instead of preventing AIDS, the drugs helped to bring it on. The mortality of AZT recipients was 25% higher than that of those in untreated control groups. This drug, originally developed for cancer chemotherapy, efficiently destroys the immune system and causes symptoms largely indistinguishable from AIDS itself. Even Burroughs Welcome, the manufacturer of AZT, makes that same assessment, but expresses it in different words. It was often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with zidovudine, AZT, administration from underlying signs of HIV disease. One can only guess what William Paul, the new American AIDS czar, was really thinking when he gave his famous Back to the Basics speech to the researchers gathered at the 10th Annual AIDS Conference in Yokohama. Paul the scientist called on AIDS researchers to re-examine all of the many assumptions of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. But Paul the politician failed to name the most important one, the central assumption that HIV causes AIDS. Paul even warned against unreflective allegiance to the status quo and criticized the funding monopoly of government-sponsored AIDS research. Research administrators need to remember that breakthroughs would come from insights that cannot be planned. Command science is no more likely to succeed than command economics. The HIV researchers in Yokohama must have sensed that HIV science was not going anywhere soon. They had grown so pessimistic about their ability to achieve any significant progress in the near future that they voted to hold international AIDS conferences in the future only every other year. In late July 1995, the 9th Annual Congress of Immunology met in San Francisco and convened what the San Francisco Chronicle called a high-wattage panel on AIDS, featuring such HIV-AIDS luminaries as Robert Gallo, Luc Montagnier, and David Baltimore. Repeating the sad refrain of HIV-AIDS research, the high-wattage panelists admitted to their peers that they had no good news and very little news at all. Mocked one national magazine on progress in AIDS research in 1993, the good news is, the bad news is the same. Gallo hoped to start antiviral gene therapy for HIV positives within the next year, but anticipated no breakthroughs in the near future. Baltimore said that despite the testing of many vaccine strategies, nothing on the horizon at the moment has the potential of being a good vaccine. Acknowledging that he had been on an HIV vaccine panel a decade before that predicted the development of an AIDS preventative within 5 to 10 years, Baltimore lamented, "Here we are 10 years later, and it is still 10 years away." Panelist Montagnier urged the continuation of the status quo. "What is important is that treatments for HIV start immediately, as soon as infection is known, even if, as Chronicle Science writer Charles Pettit noted in a charitable understatement, none of the available treatments is terribly good yet." Montagnier's semi-iconoclastic message of the 6th International AIDS Conference in San Francisco 5 years earlier, that HIV was not able to cause AIDS without a cofactor, was apparently forgotten and forgiven. How else could he have proposed preventative treatment with the available cytotoxic DNA terminators in good faith? To recommend chemotherapy against a virus that is not sufficient to cause AIDS would be irresponsible at the least. For those who might conclude the outlook for HIV research is hopelessly bleak, Gallo sounded an optimistic note. "There are many, many things to try. The list is almost endless. The crucial thing in this research and others is to find ways to stop the virus from replicating. Clearly, there are many, many things to try every year for the $7.5 billion from U.S. taxpayers alone." For the sake of everyone directly affected by the suffering caused by AIDS, however, the crucial objectives of all research would seem to be how to help sick people get better and prevent people at risk from falling prey to the complex of diseases now called AIDS. If the goal of AIDS research is changed from shoring up the never-proven HIV hypothesis to the protection of public health, then a different set of research and prevention objectives emerges, objectives that are likely to bring about real gains in the battle against AIDS much sooner and at much lower cost than the current direction. Taxpayers and HIV positives and their relatives potentially constitute the most explosive opposition to the AIDS establishment. As the failures of the war on AIDS mount up, the size of the imminent backlash grows. The longer AIDS officials resist the inevitable, the harder they will fall. Command science cannot forever hide the truth. Time, therefore, has become the most valuable ally of the HIV-AIDS debate. The AIDS debate comes out. The Group for the Scientific Reappraisal of the HIV-AIDS Hypothesis has grown from its original 24 members in 1991 to more than 400 professionals today, including more than 200 scientists and medical doctors. The group's newsletter, Reappraising AIDS, now reaches more than 1,500 people. Not only do the growing ranks of dissenting scientists serve as a barometer of frustration among researchers and physicians, but these hundreds of skeptics are also beginning to make themselves heard. They are writing books, scientific papers, and popular articles while giving public lectures and interviews with the media. Several scientific journals have invited and published dissident papers, including the German AIDS Forschung, the French journal's research in immunology from the Pasteur Institute and biomedicine and pharmacology, the British-based pharmacology and therapeutics, and the American-based perspectives in biology and medicine and biotechnology. In 1994, the editor of the International Archives of Allergy and Immunology commissioned Duisberg's article, Infectious AIDS, Stretching the Germ Theory Beyond Its Limits, under the heading, Controversy, HIV and AIDS. A Swiss virologist defended the orthodoxy. Later that year, the editor of the Dutch-based Genetica, the oldest genetics journal of its kind, asked Duisberg to edit a special issue on the HIV-AIDS controversy. The issue appeared in the spring of 1995 with a foreword by its editor-in-chief, John MacDonald. Challenges to the mainstream view that AIDS is caused by HIV have been receiving increasing attention in recent months, especially in the popular press. Part of the reason for this attention is no doubt grounded in widespread frustration resulting from the fact that after more than a decade of intensive research, there is still no cure for this deadly syndrome. A second issue which seems to be adding fuel to the controversy is the claim that a de facto conspiracy exists within the scientific community to prevent dissenting views and alternative AIDS hypotheses from being presented to the scientific and general public. See, for example, the recent London Times article by Neville Hodgkinson entitled HIV, A Conspiracy of Silence, recently published in the June-July 1994 issue of the National Times. According to the Popperian dictum, a valid scientific hypothesis can ultimately only be strengthened by the challenge of alternative views. On the other hand, ignoring charges of scientific censorship can only work to undermine the public's confidence not only in the prevailing scientific view, but also in the entire scientific establishment. In providing this forum for alternative AIDS hypothesis, Genetica hopes to dispel the notion that a conspiracy of silence exists within the scientific community. Of course, the virologists are not delighted at this increasing attention given the dissenting viewpoint. Owing to unexpected interest in the subject, the publisher of Genetica has asked Duisberg to edit a book entitled AIDS, Virus or Drug-Induced? The book will include all articles of the journal and over a dozen new articles from scientists, mathematicians, a law professor, and journalists from the London Sunday Times, the New York Native, and Spin magazine. In December 1994, Even Science, the world's most popular scientific magazine, wrote an 8-page editorial, The Duisberg Phenomenon, Duisberg and Other Voices, acknowledging that the phenomenon has not gone away and may be growing. However, the phenomenon was not allowed to describe his controversial theory to the readers of science in his own words. The author of the article was instead an experienced, plugged-in age journalist. In 1995, The Scientist, a specialty newspaper for the fast-growing population of American scientists, also took up the issue with several articles. This time, Duisberg was granted a full page to explain the drug AIDS hypothesis in his own words to the 50,000 readers of that journal. Also in 1995, the American Journal of Continuing Education in Nursing published an invited article on the drug AIDS hypothesis. In 1994, the NIDA sponsored a conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland, near Washington, D.C., to reconsider the nitrite inhalant poppers AIDS link. Duisberg was invited to attend and to discuss a grant proposal to study the ability of nitrates to cause AIDS diseases in mice. Gallo surprised some attendees and panelists by arguing that HIV is not the primary cause of KS. Kaposi sarcoma is on the list of AIDS diseases, although it may aggravate the condition once KS is caused by something else. And in the true spirit of scientific inquiry, quite different from the rancor of prior discussions of alternative causes of AIDS, Gallo called for funding of Duisberg's nitrate experiments. Duisberg's speaking invitations have also increased, but are typically restricted to smaller universities that are independent of AIDS grants and are more often issued by student groups than by faculty engaged in research. Invitations to debate the HIV/AIDS hypothesis by larger universities and international conferences all come from countries where scientists are less dependent on the approval of the CDC, the NIH, and the borough's welcome than they are in the United States, for example, from Cologne, Dortmund, Berlin, Kiel, Bonn, and Hamburg in Germany, from Vienna in Austria as a featured speaker of the Third Austrian AIDS Conference in 1992, from Bologna and Pavia in Italy for AIDS Cancer Conferences in 1993 and 1994, from Barcelona in Spain, from Belo Horizonte in Brazil, and in 1995 from the National Academy of Medicine in Caracas, Venezuela. Such opportunities are growing each year. The lay public is also beginning to hear more of the HIV debate, despite the general blackout on the issue. The ABC television programs Day One and Nightline have aired programs featuring Duisberg and other scientists critical of the HIV hypothesis, as well as segments critical of AZT therapy. Tony Brown's journal has featured many HIV dissidents on national television, including Duisberg, since 1991. Favorable attention to HIV dissidents by the American press is rapidly growing in publications, ranging from the general interest magazines Skeptic, Spin, Omni, Penthouse, Insight, New Republic, Reason, Commentary, New Age, and Policy Review, to newspapers such as the San Jose Mercury, Philadelphia Inquirer, Miami Herald, Oakland Tribune, and Los Angeles Times, to the gay interest magazines New York Native, Genre, and Men's Style, and the drug interest magazine High Times. Outside America, mainstream publications such as the Austrian Der Standard, Wiener Zeitung, and News, the Canadian Maclean's Magazine, the Italian Corriere della Sera, the German Die Vosche and Hamburger Abendblatt, the British London Sunday Times and The Continuum, the Swiss magazine Der Beobachter, and the French magazine Le Lien have all published favorable reviews of the alternative hypothesis. England has witnessed the most spectacular crack in the official wall of silence on the HIV debate. It began largely with the converge of the HIV controversy by the Sunday Times of London in 1992, spearheaded by medical writer Neville Hodgkinson. Gradually, other major British newspapers were drawn into the fray: The Independent, Financial Times, Sunday Express, Telegraph, Guardian, and Daily Mail. As both sides argued the issue more openly, the London-based scientific journal Nature finally decided it had had enough, issuing an editorial blast condemning the Sunday Times on December 9, 1993. The Times fired back, the fight becoming louder and harder to ignore over the next few months. Charge followed furious countercharge. Even the New York Times was forced for a single day to break silence on the issue and publish an article on the spectacular British feud. In the meantime, this heated HIV controversy spread to Canada. The debate has slowed down since Hodgkinson took a leave from the Sunday Times to write a book on AIDS. However, the open debate in the British press has become a major problem for AIDS officials trying to maintain their war on AIDS. The absence of an explosive AIDS epidemic has helped create skepticism toward the HIV establishment, causing serious changes in the British AIDS program. Referring to English statistics, the London Sunday Telegraph noted in late 1992, "The initial official estimates that the disease will cut a swath throughout the nation with an estimated 100,000 new cases a year by the mid-90s had to be revised downwards to 30,000 and downwards again to 13,000. Then the government actuary looked at the figures and suggested they be reduced downward yet again to 6,500, but even this has proved to be a six-fold overestimate of the number of new cases this year. By this summer, when these results were published, it had become apparent that with such a low prevalence rate, there was no heterosexual AIDS epidemic, nor was there likely to be one. As a result, the British government has decided to cut out AIDS education programs aimed at the general public, focusing instead on the risk groups. Even the legal profession has taken on interest in the HIV debate. Duisberg's information and testimony has been used in the courtroom defenses of two HIV-positive men, both accused of assault with a deadly weapon for having sexual intercourse with HIV-negative women. Other defense attorneys have sought similar information, always leading to confidential settlements. A group named Project AIDS International has formed in Los Angeles, preparing materials and talking with interested attorneys over the possibility of suing Burroughs Wellcome for the production of AZT. Such a lawsuit has already become reality in England, the world headquarters of Burroughs Wellcome. Sue Threakall is a school teacher whose husband, a hemophiliac, tested positive for HIV in 1985. He remained basically healthy until he began taking AZT in 1989. From that point forward, Bob Threakall's life went downhill. 1 year later, he had to quit his job, suffering severe weight loss, thrush, stomach upsets, poor sleep patterns, sore mouth, continued sinus infections, weakness, breathlessness, loss of appetite, etc. Early in 1991, he died, confused, delirious, wasted, constant diarrhea, unable to swallow, and with hardly any normal lung tissue left. After contacting Peter Duisberg and absorbing the information refuting the HIV hypothesis, an angry Sue Threakall turned to the courts. In January 1994, she won a government commitment to finance her lawsuit, guaranteeing her case will proceed regardless of her own financial condition, and she filed for damages against Burroughs Wellcome. Several more people, including hemophiliacs, have joined the growing list of plaintiffs. By 1995, the HIV controversy had even made a convert of noted Wall Street short seller Michael Murphy of Half Moon Bay, California. Men's Style magazine has investigated that story. Murphy publishes one of the most influential newsletters for short sellers, the Overpriced Stock Index. Unlike traditional stockbrokers, short sellers make money when a company's stock price falls, not rises. Murphy, who closely follows high-tech pharmaceutical and biotech stocks, had become a Duisberg true believer by November and devoted his entire November newsletter to a layman's explanation of Duisbergian theory and how that would translate into a huge short-selling profit for people who sold Burroughs Wellcome stock soon before the share price crashed in the wake of impending public realization that HIV did not cause AIDS and, therefore, AZT did not work. The headline read in all caps, HIV does not cause AIDS. AIDS is not contagious. AIDS is not spread by sexual contact. AZT kills patients. He followed up with an equally hyperbolic December issue. The double play happened when Wall Street Journal columnist William Powers came across the Overpriced Stock Index. Powers, who semi-regularly pens the Herd on Wall Street opinion column, was intrigued. When he first came out with his views, he put out a press release, and I called to make sure it wasn't a prank, the affable Power says. Murphy does have a following. He isn't the most powerful short seller, but he's one of the few that will put his money where his mouth is. I write about anything that might affect the public stock, so I let him say his piece. Did he ever? On January 20th, 1995, Powers' column, complete with a trademark journal pen and ink sketch of Murphy, gave itself over to Murphy's exhortations to sell Burroughs Wellcome stock, that AZT causes AIDS, and that the disease is not sexually transmitted. The column marked the most credible, if not the highest profile, mainstream depiction of Duisberg to date. Most people outside of the scientific community don't know anything about HIV, frets NIAID spokesman Greg Folkers, and when it's in the Wall Street Journal, it's given instant credibility. When money talks, even politicians listen. In March 1995, the new Republican congressman, Gil Gutnacht, had grown suspicious of the insatiable appetite of the American AIDS establishment for funding. Seeing an opportunity to save some billions of tax dollars, Gutnacht sent the following critical letter to Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala, Anthony Fauci, and five other leading American AIDS officials. Dear Dr. Fauci, as a freshman representative who sits on the Government Reform and Oversight and Science Committees of the 104th Congress, one of my concerns is the AIDS policy of the U.S. government. 12 years, $35 billion, and 270,000 deaths since the beginning of the AIDS crisis in America, there is still no cure, no vaccine, and no effective treatment for the disease. Considering the social and financial costs involved so far, I would like to request your responses to a series of questions. 1. I am told that A. There is not a single documented case of a healthcare worker without any other AIDS risk who contracted AIDS from the over 401,749 American AIDS patients in 10 years. B. The partner of AIDS patient Rock Hudson, the wife and 8-year-old daughter of late AIDS patient Arthur Ashe, as well as the husband of the late AIDS patient Elizabeth Glaser, are HIV and AIDS free. What is the scientific proof that AIDS is contagious? 2. Is there any study showing that HIV-positive American men or women who are not on recreational drugs or AZT or receive transfusions ever got AIDS from HIV? Are there any documented cases of tertiary heterosexual AIDS transmission? AIDS transmitted to a non-risk group heterosexual who in turn transmits AIDS to another non-risk group heterosexual. 3. After more than 10 years of intensive research and over 100,000 papers published on HIV/AIDS, is there a study that proves that HIV is the cause of AIDS? 4. How do you explain HIV-free AIDS cases? I am told there are over 4,621 on record beyond naming them ICL, idiopathic CD4, lymphocytopenial. 5. If infectious HIV is the cause of AIDS, why is Kaposi sarcoma, the signal disease of AIDS, exclusively observed in male homosexuals? 6. Why are there long-term survivors? 12 to 15 years of HIV. Is there medical precedent for a fatal virus with such a long latency period? Are long-term survivors generally people who do not use recreational drugs and AZT? 7. How does the medical community explain the fact that the median life expectancy of American hemophiliacs has increased from 11 in 1972 to 27 in 1987, although 75% were infected by HIV in the decade before 1984? 8. Can federal efforts ignore the theory that recreational drugs and AZT cause AIDS, considering that 30% of all American AIDS patients are intravenous drug users and that nearly all others are users of oral recreational drugs and/or AZT, DDL, or DDC? 9. Considering that there is little scientific proof of the exact linkage of HIV and AIDS, is it ethical to prescribe AZT, a toxic chain terminator of DNA developed 30 years ago as cancer chemotherapy, to 150,000 Americans, among them pregnant women and newborn babies, as an anti-HIV drug? Is there any scientific precedent of a virus causing an autoimmune disease? What do Kaposi sarcoma, lymphoma, dementia, cervical cancer, and wasting disease have to do with immune deficiency? If HIV never claims more than 1 out of 1,000 cells every other day, and the body replaces at least 30 out of 1,000 during the same period, how does HIV damage the immune system? 11. In how many American AIDS cases was HIV actually found? How many presumptive diagnoses of HIV have been recorded? Do HIV antibody tests cross-react with other microbes, viruses, vaccines, or other natural or artificial substances? 12. Considering the history of the HIV/AIDS hypothesis and its inability to come up with a cure, vaccine, or effective treatment for AIDS in the past 10 years, how much money has been spent by government agencies on alternative hypothesis AIDS research, for example, Duisberg, Root Bernstein, Lowe? Advancement in medicine depends entirely upon experimentation, objectivity, testing all hypotheses, and most importantly, debate in order to find the truth. Consider this initial inquiry my contribution to this important debate. I eagerly await your response to the above questions. Sincerely, Gil Gutnecht, U.S. Representative, C.C. Robert Gallo, Harold Jaffe, Bill Paul, Harold Varmus, Patsy Fleming, David Satcher, Donna Shalala. 4 months after he had sent out his 12 questions, Gutnecht received, on July 10th, a 7-page letter signed by Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala. According to a footnote on page 1, the letter had been prepared by CDC official P. Drotman. The letter addressed each of Gutnecht's questions with undocumented ex cathedra assertions that are worthless for a scientific debate. Although HIV is the underlying cause of AIDS, much remains to be known about exactly how HIV causes immune deficiency. However, this incomplete understanding does not indicate that the virus is harmless. Why some persons exposed to HIV become infected while others do not is also not known. 1. Some individuals effectively combat this viral illness for a longer time than others. The precise mechanism of cell death following HIV infection remains a topic for research. The overwhelming evidence indicates that HIV causes AIDS and that use of contaminated equipment for injection of drugs is one major route of transmission of HIV. In answer to Gutnecht's question 2, what is the scientific proof that AIDS is contagious, the response shifted from evasion to double talk. Regarding scientific proof that AIDS is contagious, before the discovery of HIV, evidence from epidemiologic studies involving tracing of patients' sex partners and cases occurring in blood recipients clearly indicated that the underlying cause of the condition was an infectious agent. But CDC official Drotman must have known the definitive multi-center study co-authored and sponsored by the CDC, which showed in 1989 that morbidity and mortality of blood transfusion recipients with and without HIV is exactly the same. Drotman must have even better known two statements that he had published himself in 1995. 1. Regarding transfusion AIDS, but few transfusion recipients have developed KS, Kaposi sarcoma, the signal AIDS disease, even though many of their donors were homosexual and bisexual men who developed KS later. 2. Regarding sexual transmission of AIDS, few clusters of persons with AIDS-related KS have been reported. Such clusters may be difficult to identify because most persons with AIDS have had contact with many different people. In particular, drug users and homosexual and bisexual men may have had contact with hundreds of partners that they did not know very well. Clearly, scientific truth was not served by Shalala's letter. The tone of Shalala's answer to Gutnick is virtually the same as that chosen by Blattner, Gallo, and Temin to answer Duisberg in Science in 1988. Both answers argue on the basis of authority instead of science. In that spirit, Shalala answered Gutnick's last question about funding alternative hypothesis AIDS research. To deviate funds from scientifically sound findings to those that lack evidence would be unconscionable. The complete Shalala letter is available from the CDC on request. Despite these openings, the HIV/AIDS establishment is retaining its full grip on power. The many billions of dollars spent each year by the federal government on biomedical research, and especially those billions devoted to HIV research and control, have purchased enormous influence with every significant interest group involved in AIDS. Scientists, as frustrated or uncertain as they may become over their lack of progress, can never afford to destroy their careers by turning against the peer-enforced dogma. The pharmaceutical industry, particularly Burroughs-Wellcome, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Hoffmann-LaRoche, the producers of AZT, DDL, and DDC respectively, cannot afford to lose their profitable AIDS drugs. AIDS activist groups would hardly want to lose favor with their pharmaceutical patrons or the CDC. The communications media also will not endanger its cozy relationship with the CDC, NIH, and other key agencies. All these groups must continue to support the war on HIV, ignoring or suppressing all genuine debate. These conflicts of interest between the trusted commitment of scientists to academic freedom and peer pressures to collaborate with the commercial and scientific establishments betray the taxpayers and the patient's faith. Most important, the great majority of the public at large and the AIDS patients have had little or no opportunity to find out that questions exist about the HIV hypothesis, much less to hear a fair presentation of the arguments. If the public were to discover the facts and how the debate had been hidden from them, they would likely demand an end to the war on AIDS. How Command Science Betrays Public Trust. For the public ever to break command science, it must first understand the basis of its enormous powers. The medical establishment derives these powers from three sources. 1. Enforced consensus through peer review. 2. Consensus through commercialization. And 3. The fear of disease, particularly infectious disease. 1. Enforced consensus through peer review. The initial power base of the establishment is grant allocation. No medical scientist could even hope to make a career without a research grant from the NIH. Grant allocation selects and rewards conformism with the establishment view. Nonconformists are eliminated by the outwardly democratic peer review system, advertised by the orthodoxy as an independent jury system that provides checks and balances. However, a truly independent jury would be fatal for the establishment. Indeed, a grant awarded to test an unorthodox theory of AIDS that proved to be successful would be an end to the orthodoxy itself. Therefore, orthodox scientists with NIH grants are carefully selected as the peers to review investigator-initiated grant applications. The system works because the peers serve the orthodoxy by serving their own vested interests. Under this review system, a scientist's access to funding, promotions, publication in journals, ability to win prizes, and invitations to conferences are entirely controlled by his peers. This absurd situation puts one's competitors in charge of one's career, a direct conflict of interest. Imagine if every new automobile or new computer had to be approved by competing corporations before being released to the market. Products would cease improving, and the market would experience a steady decline in quality. Innovation and competition would die. Such inherent problems have led to public criticisms of peer review over the past 20 years, with various congressmen and even the Office of Management and Budget voicing objections to the system. The stifling effect of peer review becomes worse as the number of peers increases, one of the direct effects of overfunded science. The growing number of researchers creates a herd effect, drowning out the voice of the lone scientist who questions official wisdom. Researchers begin spending more time networking and seeking to build coalitions of allies rather than stepping on toes by raising unpopular questions. When the number of scientists in a field is small, they all feel more free to break into conflicting factions with different opinions. A field crowded with peers quickly stifles all such independent thinking, imposing a consensus on the group as a whole. For example, if in a small group an innovative scientist challenges an established opponent, the loser may join the winner or choose another field. But if one innovative scientist takes on 100,000 orthodox colleagues and the challenger wins, the consequences for the orthodoxy would be disastrous if it were not for the peer review system. Hundreds of thousands could not practically be converted or easily reemployed, nor would so many be willing to concede defeat to a single challenger. The challenging hypothesis would have to be aborted by the orthodoxy before it is born. The power of peer review. Former NIH Director Bernadine Healy, when questioned during her confirmation hearings before the Senate in 1991, brought up this same problem. She referred to the competition between Mozart and his less competent but more popular rival Salieri. One journalist summarized her point. Salieri would probably have fared better than Mozart in the equivalent of today's peer review system. Healy said, but if medicine is to succeed, the Mozarts must be allowed to flourish as well. As long as a scientist's work is reviewed only by competitors within his own field, peer review will crush genuine science. At a minimum, a scientist should be reviewed only by researchers outside his field, those without such direct conflicts of interest. The further removed from the grant applicant's field, the less biased the reviewers will be. There are numerous well-qualified researchers in related fields who could objectively serve on review committees. Unfortunately, the AIDS establishment, so far from embracing concepts of impartial review, was the first to break even with the standard practice of restricting scientific decisions to scientific peers by appointing faithful activists and risk groups to regular science policy meetings. For example, Martin Delaney from Project Inform, San Francisco, serving as advisor to Anthony Fauci at NIH. Through peer review, the federal government has attained a near monopoly on science. A handful of federal agencies, primarily the NIH, dominate research policies and effectively dictate the official dogma. HIV research provides a case in point. By declaring the virus the cause of AIDS at a press conference sponsored by the Department of Health and Human Services, NIH researcher Robert Gallo swung the entire medical establishment and even the rest of the world behind his hypothesis. Once such a definitive statement is made, the difficulty of retracting it only increases with time. As the situation stands now, scientists who sit as peer reviewers for non-federal granting agencies generally receive NIH funding themselves and thus tend to enforce the federal dogma even on other organizations. 2. Consensus through commercialization. The second basis of establishment power is achieved by the commercialization of science. The biotechnology industry arose mainly to supply equipment and reagents to NIH-funded laboratories. As the NIH budget has increased, so has the subsidized market for biotechnology products. The pharmaceutical industry likewise has profited from monopolies granted by the FDA, which bans competing therapies. Both the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries feed opportunistically off the NIH largesse. Naturally, some of these federally provided corporate profits find their way back to scientists in the form of patent royalties, consultantships, paid board positions, and stock ownership. These same scientists often sit in judgment of their fellow researchers as peer reviewers, deciding whether a competitor should be funded or allowed to publish. Such commercial conflicts of interest have almost totally permeated biomedical scientific institutions today, whether universities or the NIH or FDA. Researchers have made a regular policy of looking the other way or even rewriting the rules to allow such behavior. The laws of marketing force consensus even more effectively than peer review. In order for a research product to find a market, the underlying hypothesis for the product must be accepted by a majority of the practitioners in the field. Without such informal support, a product would never stand a chance in the formal review process by peers of the FDA, a division of the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The FDA, like its sister HHS divisions, follows the national HIV/AIDS dogma and selects its review committees accordingly. Thus, commercial success can be achieved only by consensus. For example, an AIDS product that is not based on the HIV/AIDS hypothesis would not be approved unless it miraculously cured AIDS overnight. By contrast, a toxic chemotherapy like AZT, which has yet to cure the first AIDS patient and was even rejected as a cancer drug 30 years ago, proved to be a commercial success overnight after FDA approval. Moreover, marketing arrests the evolution of research to the status of a successful market product. It would be economic suicide for a scientist to advance research that would render his established commercial products obsolete. This applies to Gallo's NIH patent for the HIV test, for which Gallo's salary is supplemented by the NIH since 1985 by $100,000 annually for the duration of the patent. Many other AIDS researchers are HIV millionaires, since non-government scientists are not limited to supplements of $100,000 annually. Conflicts of interest must inevitably arise when huge sums of money are poured into science. With 7.5 billion federal AIDS dollars available annually, people will always find ways to sell their research. Annually, more than 2.5 million HIV tests at $50 apiece, about 200,000 AZT therapies at $10,000 per person per year, innumerable HIV DNA tests at more than $300 apiece, T-cell counts, blood transfusions, vaccines, and many other commodities are sold. The only workable solution lies in restoring science ethics to their status of 20 years ago, when all commercial applications of government-sponsored biological science were prohibited. Both peer review and commercialization have killed the evolution of AIDS research by penalizing conceptual innovation and fixing the status quo. And monopolies kill science even faster than economies. 3. The fear of disease. Traditionally, the power of medical sciences has been based on the fear of disease, particularly infectious disease. The HIV/AIDS establishment has exploited this instrument of power to its limits. From individual AIDS educators insisting on condoms, to activists calling for clean needles and experimental drugs, to doctors prescribing AZT, to the CDC calling for increased funding of its war against viruses, fear is a non-negotiable argument. The bloated science bureaucracy, and particularly the virus hunting program, have succeeded for decades, mostly by using the war motif. Wars are fought most effectively in the name of fear. James Shannon first squeezed extra money out of Congress by declaring war on polio. Richard Nixon mobilized researchers behind the war on cancer. David Baltimore and his allies engineered the war on AIDS. Now the NIH is declaring a war on breast cancer, which is doomed to finish in the same cemetery as the other war on cancer. Scientific fashion today blames breast cancer on specific genetic mutations, which hard evidence proves harmless and irrelevant to the cause of the tumor. Increased monies for breast cancer research will lock into place the scientific mistakes and stifle all attempts to discover the real causes of the disease. Progress will be delayed and lives will be lost from too much funding, all in the name of war. But while a state of war can mobilize public fear and support for a time, the tactic eventually backfires, creating public opposition once defeat becomes obvious. The wars on cancer and AIDS have produced nothing but tragedy. "Germs are back," declared one newspaper article ominously in July of 1993. Those who track trends in advertising and who sell disinfecting products confirm that today's Americans are acutely attuned to the invisible microbial world and its potential hazards. rebounding tuberculosis, undercooked fast food burgers in Seattle, tainted tap water in Milwaukee, and the mystery disease in the Southwest serves only to encourage our concern about microscopic invaders, it seems. Quoting journalism professor Gail Baker Woods on this rising public fear, the article then noted its biggest cause. The trend, which Woods says includes not only disinfecting products, but also newly introduced clear products with their aura of purity, is in part a response to fear of AIDS and a need to feel immune from such invisible threats. The fear of microbes is resurging at a most ironic time. Infectious diseases, which once were the leading killers, have stopped killing people in the industrial world. Today, fewer than 1% of all deaths in the first world result from contagion. Heart disease has become the major cause, followed by cancer, and life expectancies have grown nearly to 80 years. The polio epidemic marked the end of the era of infectious disease for industrial societies. Yet by blaming AIDS, cancer, and other modern non-contagious diseases on microbes, the virus-hunting research establishment has pointlessly resurrected this old anxiety. That modern science could so effectively terrify the public of a long-vanished threat testifies to its enormous power. But to some extent, the fear of catching disease has always helped medical authorities, making the lay public more willing to yield money and freedoms for the sake of an answer. Researchers discovered this gold mine of popularity once Robert Koch had proved in 1882 that a bacterium caused tuberculosis. Soon, newly graduated medical doctors scurried to find the bacteria causing every conceivable disease. Once blamed, the right germ could open the door to a vaccine or public health measures to control the disease and to place in the textbooks a secure career and perhaps even a Nobel Prize. Certainly, microbes were easier to blame for a disease than spending years of frustrating effort in search of complex or unfamiliar causes. Microbes were tangible, a well-defined target at which to aim. Enthusiasm turned to fashion, and fashion to a stampede. Bacteria were being found even in non-contagious diseases. Scurvy, pellagra, SMON, and beriberi, among others, were each in turn blamed on a series of microbes, sometimes leading to control measures that only exacerbated these epidemics and always delaying the search for missing vitamins in the diet or toxic medical and recreational drugs. Merely isolating a germ often served to implicate it as being guilty for some disease. Few people stopped to consider the possibility that most germs were simply harmless. Bacteria hunting temporarily disappeared with the end of contagious epidemics. Meanwhile, virus hunting arrived on the scene, seeing its heyday primarily in the polio epidemic. Once polio disappeared, however, the microbe hunters should have dropped their outmoded speciality, developing new methods and ideas for studying other types of disease. But because of a series of political decisions during the 1950s, they did not. In 1951, Alexander Lang Muir founded the Epidemic Intelligence Service, EIS, of the CDC, intended to act as an early warning detection and control system for contagious epidemics. The EIS and the CDC would go on during the next several decades to rise nationwide alarm bells over minor disease outbreaks, while falsely labeling leukemia, Legionnaire's disease, and AIDS as infectious. The NIH, the other federal cornerstone of modern biomedical research, underwent radical restructuring after James Shannon took over in 1955. Determined to create the largest scientific research establishment in world history, Shannon milked Congress for exponentially increasing budgets by launching massive new programs, most notably the War on Polio and the Virus Cancer Program. The new NIH monies went to purchase greater quantities of data gathering and to recruit enormous numbers of new people into the swelling ranks of researchers. The outcome of these two changes was predictable. Microbe hunting reappeared with a vengeance, seizing every available disease to blame on a germ. NIH funding patterns ensured that the virus hunters would predominate over the others. In trying to explain the slow, degenerative diseases of nerve and brain tissues or of cancer, the virus hunters were forced to improvise. Carlton Gajdoszek, who performed questionable research in which he never could isolate a virus from Kuru disease, nevertheless became known as the father of the slow virus idea and received the 1976 Nobel Prize for the notion. According to this hypothesis, a virus could infect a host one day and, despite being permanently neutralized by the immune system, could somehow cause a fatal disease years later. Although a blatant violation of the logic behind Koch's postulates and the germ theory, Gajdoszek's slow virus hypothesis captured the imagination of scientists and reshaped their whole approach to medicine. Hilary Kaprowski, Robert Gallo, and David Baltimore numbered among the converts who searched avidly for slow viruses and eventually led AIDS research. By the time the AIDS epidemic surfaced, the outcome of research on the new syndrome had been predetermined. AIDS in the United States and Europe fits the pattern of non-infectious diseases, and for several reasons is likely to be a product of the drug abuse epidemic of recent years. Nevertheless, virus hunters jumped on the new opportunity, the retrovirologists being in the right position to have a retrovirus, HIV, officially declared the cause. As with so many products of modern virus hunting, HIV completely failed the test of Koch's postulates, but just finding it was all the evidence the virologists needed. A new article from 1987 shows how irrational fear of the AIDS virus affects the lay public. Fear of acquired immune deficiency syndrome is sweeping heterosexual society on both coasts. Restaurants in gay districts of San Francisco, New York, and the Los Angeles area are shunned by many people, and the Bon Appetit restaurant in suburban Sacramento lost numerous customers after the January AIDS death of a chef who worked there 5 years earlier. At Gay Men's Health Crisis, Inc., which helps AIDS patients in New York, we consistently have television crews who will not come inside our building, said spokeswoman Lori Behrman. About half the 4,000 calls received monthly by the center's AIDS hotline are from worried well people, half of whom are needlessly concerned about getting AIDS from swimming pools, insects, or non-risky sex practices, said hotline coordinator Jerry Johnson. This cynical manipulation of public fear may bring in the money for the AIDS lobby, but it creates human tragedy for everyone else. From Miami, Florida, comes the personal account of some real victims of the war on AIDS. Cesar and Teresa Schmitz and their baby daughter Louise, whose lives were nearly destroyed by the AIDS virus propaganda. Teresa herself related the story in December of 1993. In January 1992, we found out my husband was HIV positive. I will never forget that morning. I will never forget the first 3 or 4 days after that test result. It was surely the most devastating experience I ever had in my entire life. Abruptly, it was all gone. No more future, no more nothing. From that moment on, life would be waiting for death. The worst part was to face my beautiful and adorable 1-year-old little girl. She was condemned to die. Out of my despair, I did anything I could to get an answer about the chances of my baby surviving. The trained professionals at the 800 numbers that I called gave me answers like, "Oh my God," after I said that my husband was HIV positive and I had a baby. They even asked, "Is her hair falling? Is she losing weight?" I could not allow my beautiful and precious baby to go through all that suffering. I could not imagine her going from hospital to hospital, having needles stuck in her little arm, seeing her going skinnier and skinnier. I could not take that. The only way out of that despair, of that suffering, was to kill ourselves. There was no other solution for us but this one. It would end the pain and the nightmare right at the beginning. 2 weeks later, my test result came out. I was negative. So it meant that Louise was negative, too. Now Cesar was the only one of us condemned to die. March 1991, not even 2 months after the results, Cesar started with the symptoms of AIDS: diarrhea, nausea, weight loss, and so on. The strange thing was that the symptoms began right after he started taking AZT. He was feeling so bad, so sick, he decided against his doctor's will to stop taking AZT. All of a sudden, like magic, no more symptoms. He was healthy and normal again and remained so since then in 1995. He goes regularly to a clinic for lab tests. The doctor thinks he is doing very well but insists and pressures him to take AZT or its similar because it is the only way. The doctor's faith is so strong that he does not listen to Cesar. Our marriage was falling apart, no sex life for 2 years. He did not want to take any chances of contaminating me. The only sure way was abstinence. About a month ago, I decided to write to Dr. Peter Duisberg. After talking to him, my life changed. Everything went back to normal. Cesar and I are having a really normal life. We are planning our second child. We got to the conclusion this whole HIV hypothesis is a mistake, a tragic hoax. And once the AIDS virus will no longer scare the American public, the CDC stands ready with new superbugs. After AIDS, superbugs give medicine the jitters. These are the powers of the medical establishment that will continue to suppress the AIDS debate and have been able to obstruct the already available solution for a long time. While hundreds of thousands of people die of heavy drug abuse or from their AZT prescriptions, AIDS officials insist on pushing condoms, sterile needles, and HIV testing on a terrified population. AIDS propaganda is ubiquitous, observes Charles Ortleb, publisher of The Homosexual Interest, New York native. 10% of every brain in America must be filled with posters, news items, condom warnings, etc., etc. The iconography of AIDS is everywhere. Part of the big lie that some activists promote over and over in an Orwellian way is that AIDS is somehow not on the front burner of America. AIDS propaganda has become part of the very air that Americans breathe. All of this is based on a war against a harmless virus waged with deadly treatments and misleading public health advice. This is truly a medical disaster on an unprecedented scale. Ironically, HIV positives actually have no reason to fear. As with uninfected people, those who stay off recreational drugs and avoid AZT will never die of AIDS. Antibody-positive people can live absolutely normal lives. Worldwide, 17 million of the 18 million HIV positives certainly do. Those at real risk of AIDS could help their fate if they were only informed that recreational drugs cause AIDS, and those with AIDS could recover if they were informed that AZT and its analogs inevitably terminate DNA synthesis and thus life. When the public finally catches on to these deceptive tactics, the HIV hypothesis of AIDS and its proponents will find harsh judgment. AIDS researchers will do their best to control the downfall, accepting the idea of cofactors and gradually relegating HIV to a less important role in the syndrome, a process that has just begun. In December 1994, Kaposi sarcoma, once the signature disease of AIDS, was taken off the list of HIV diseases. For the time being, another virus was causing that AIDS disease. They will probably even try to take credit themselves for discovering the unimportance of HIV, disguising the reversal as further progress in AIDS research. But the fact that they are stubbornly fighting such change and even accelerating the war on AIDS with new, toxic antiviral drugs indicates they may learn only too late. This time, the public may hold biomedical researchers and public health experts accountable, and misguided microbe hunting will meet its long overdue judgment. This has been an Audible Inc. production of Inventing the AIDS Virus, written by Peter H. Duesberg, narrated by J. Arthur Tripp. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright, 1996, by Peter Duesberg and Brian J. Ellison. Production copyright, 2013, by Audible, Inc.